Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with the passing of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was small in stature, but a giant in the fight for equality, only the second woman to be seated on the nation's highest court. And she knew that her journey would pave the way for women everywhere. Here is a bit of what she told the graduating class at Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts, during a commencement address in 1997.
No door should be closed to people willing to spend the hours of effort needed to make dreams come true. So hold fast to your dreams and work hard to make them a reality. And as you pursue your path in life, leave tracks, just as others have been way pavers for your aspirations and achievements. So you should aid those who will follow in your way.
Associate Justice Ginsburg died Friday night. She was 87. And today we want to explore how she shaped the law and our legal community here in Boston. To reflect on her life and legacy, we're joined now by Ron Cass. He is the Dean Emeritus of Boston University School of Law, and he knew Justice Ginsburg very well. Dean Cass, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be with you.
Dean Cass, I know you lost a friend. You knew Ruth Bader Ginsburg for decades, and I'm sorry for your loss. And I wanted to ask you, where were you when you heard the news, and what was your first thought?
Well, I was at home when I heard the news, and I was very sad. And obviously, she had fought a number of different cancers for quite a long time and had a lot of health issues the last few years. But she was also someone, when people say she fought the diseases, she was a fighter, and she did fight them and fought them very well for a long time.
You know, she was a private individual and an intensely public person, especially in this moment. What is it like to grieve someone close to you with this private dimension, but also it all unfolding so openly in the public over the last few days?
Well, it's something that I've been through before. Justice Scalia was a dear friend for over 40 years. And when something happens publicly, there is a difficulty to keeping private what you're thinking and feeling. But it also goes with the territory of knowing people who make a mark on the world, make a mark on the country, and make a mark on the law. And you take pride in your friends, you take pride in what they've done, and you grieve privately as much as you can.
I appreciate you spending some time talking about her with us today, Dean Cass. You talked about this mark that she made on the world and on the law, and we've heard a lot about that over the last couple of days. I'm so interested in the marks that she made on people and in our community here in Boston. For you, what did you admire or emulate most about her as a judge?
Well, one of the things, before I get to her as a judge, you have to talk about her as a person, because when you said she was small in stature, she was a tiny person, but she punched well above her weight, and she carried herself not with the air of someone small, but with the air of someone who occupied the space around her gently. When you talked with her, there'd be a twinkle in her eye when she was saying something she knew was funny. She wasn't boisterous, but she did have a great sense of humor, and she had a great appreciation for people, like her friend Nino Scalia. She loved other people, and she cherished friendships with them and didn't base the friendships on agreement, which is a great gift these days.
I want to ask you, I was so struck by you saying she punched above her weight. Do you have a particular memory of her that sticks with you about when she did punch above her weight?
Well, all the time when she would be talking, she would very clearly and very directly make the points she wanted to make. She and Justice Scalia had a deep, deep friendship that lasted for decades. She and her husband Marty and Nino and Maureen were all friends. But Ruth never held back. She would give as good as she got. She would needle Nino the same way he would needle her. And when she was on the bench, she would make her point. She would not be someone who intervened excessively. And she always talked very quietly. But she had a point to make when she talked. She would make it, and she would make clear that people understood the point she was making.
Tell us more now about how you saw her as a force on the bench, as a judge.
Well, she was someone who, she had a different, and again, let me contrast her with Justice Scalia. Justice Scalia was very much rooted in text. He began with the text. He began with canons on how to interpret a text. Ruth had different approaches to different types of cases. She had cases where she was very intuitive. She had a sense of what she thought was right, and she wanted to see it in the case. It didn't mean she could always get where she wanted to go, but she had a sense of what it meant to have a right answer in certain cases. And so she and Nino would reason from different starting points. There were other cases where she thought there was not so much a visceral sense of what was the right answer as a case that was rooted in technical considerations. There were some intellectual property cases where you can see her working through the provisions in the law and comparing the provisions and thinking, if this provision says this, then that provision, which uses a different word, has to mean something different. And she would go through and explain that very carefully. And then there were yet other cases where she was very much approaching it from a common sense standpoint. There was a decision last year in a case, and it was a trademark case, and the question was whether you could get a trademark on something that used a generic word. The word was booking, and the case was about booking.com, and she was reasoning about the case from the standpoint of what consumers would think, what was instinctive to consumers as they heard this case, what was the meaning of the term to them. So she had her ways of approaching different cases. In certain cases, they were very much grounded in her sense of right.
I want to pivot just a little bit. We've talked about her as a person. We've talked to her about her as a judge. She was an icon, a symbol as well. She was the notorious RBG. And she also was a pioneer for working women and mothers. I want to play, it's a long clip, but I want to play some sound for you, Dean Kass. It's a moment from a conversation she had at Wheaton College in May of 1997 as part of a C-SPAN program called Public Lives, Private Partnerships.
Yes, I was hard on my kids. I did go over their homework. I made them do it over. But I said the greatest tribute a mother could have is my child was having her first child in Paris. And it was a difficult birth. And she was feeling rotten, just rotten, the next day. And she called, and we were on the telephone for hours. But the idea that she would call me and not a best friend, or that to talk her out of what almost every woman goes through soon after childbirth, when you're feeling ungainly and maybe the child isn't breastfeeding, and you're feeling rejected and unattractive, and that when she was at that moment, she called me, so I figured I'd done something right.
I must tell you that she called collect.
So, I mean, as a woman and as a mother, it speaks to me so much to hear a Supreme Court justice being able to talk about that conversation and that relationship with her daughter. Did her ability to affect perceptions of women in law, did that come home to our community here in Boston? Did we feel those effects here?
Well, I think those effects are felt everywhere. And when you talk about her as a notorious RBG, she had an air about her which she delighted in, and she delighted in being on the cutting edge. When my daughter, who grew up knowing a lot of justices, saw her, Ruth didn't want a photo She wanted a selfie. She wanted my daughter to have the picture on the phone and then send the picture to her. She was always someone who took pleasure in being that one extra step ahead of where most people would be. And she communicated that to a lot of others, including very young girls.
Were you comfortable with the iconic status to which she rose very late in her career? I mean, how about a justice of the Supreme Court as a pop culture icon?
Well, we have two justices who served on the Supreme Court at the same time, who were both people whose personalities endeared them to a broader crowd. Both she and Justice Scalia were known outside what would be their usual circle. They both were fans of performance. They both were fans of opera. They both actually performed on stage. Well, they were more standbys in that role, but generally when they were on stage, they were the performers and they liked performing. And I think that from time to time, there are people in law who command that sort of attention. And you can't plan it, you can't schedule it, but you have to appreciate it when you see it.
And lastly, my last question to you, Dean Cass, in just a few words, what do you want our listeners to remember about her?
More than anything else, I want them to remember that she was someone who didn't define herself just by what she did. She enjoyed her family. She enjoyed her friends. She didn't draw lines of friendship based on agreement. She drew them based on what she saw in the people she was friends with. And she had the capacity to see what was positive in people she didn't agree with at all. Her friendship with Justice Scalia, both of them adored the other. Both of them admired the other. And both of them were absolutely persuaded that the other was dead wrong a lot of the time.
That's Ron Cass, Dean Emeritus of Boston University School of Law. Dean Cass, I really appreciate you spending the time with us today. Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed being with you.
Listeners, we want to invite you into the conversation as well. I'll ask you what I asked Dean Cass. Where were you Friday night when you heard the news that Ruth Bader Ginsburg died? And what did you think? How did you feel? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And especially if you're a law student or a young lawyer, we would love to hear what kind of role model Justice Ginsburg has played for you in your work. Call us and join the conversation. We have two wonderful women now to reflect with us further. Joining us is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, welcome back.
Good to be on again.
And we have Renee Landers, professor of law and director of the Health Law Concentration at Suffolk University. Professor Landers, welcome back to you as well.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Nancy, Judge Gertner, I'm going to turn to you first because you have lost two friends from the legal community in the last 2 weeks. First Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Ralph Gantz and now Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And you have been gracious enough to reflect with us here on Radio Boston both times. And that is a lot of loss. What is going through your mind today?
Well, the troubling thing was that I had gone to visit Judge Gantz's family on Friday night, lingered to talk about him and the family, and heard about Justice Ginsburg on my way home. Mm. And it to say that it was crushing on just about all levels would be an understatement. Just for Judge Gantz, he was carving out a Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court that was moving in a different direction, or at least preserving the sort of progressive court that it had been for all these years, even when the Supreme Court had moved more rightward. For Justice Ginsburg, it was the loss of really more than just a vote, more than just an icon. She was a force in the legal community and significantly had been for, 40 years. And she was a friend, and she was a role model for us, although that is such a overused term. She was what I wanted to be.
Renee, Let me just invite you to add there.
Well, I agree with what Nancy has said about the crushing loss of the last week. I too visited Justice Gantz's family last week. And so coming on the heels of that news, while, you know, given Justice Ginsburg's age and her various health concerns, you know, it was not surprising that she perhaps did not have much time left. But it still was just very heartrending to hear the news, because when I think about how all of our lives are different today because of her, it's an amazing contribution to society that few people can claim. The cases on gender discrimination, sex discrimination, really have paved the way for women to have more equal lives in the workplace, in their families, and also in society. One of her, you know, the first cases that she litigated before the Supreme Court involved, one of the cases she litigated before the Supreme Court involved the blanket exemption for women to serve on juries. And, you know, women need to have to take responsibility for, you know, serving in these, you know, public processes, just as men do. And so I just think that this contribution is something that I think young people will try to make sure that these gains, are maintained and that we continue to advance.
I just want to put the number out for our listeners again, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What does the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg mean for us as a community and a country? What have you learned about her in the last few days that surprised you or that you didn't know? Where were you and what were you thinking when you first found out about her death on Friday? Join the conversation. Nancy, my brain is kind of stuck on you talking about this woman who you knew well, but who was also a legal giant, as the person you wanted to be. I mean, that's really saying something.
Well, I remember, as I wrote in an op-ed I recently did, that I was in my 20s. I was, a very young lawyer. We had, the students at Yale Law School had put together a Women in Law course. It was one of the first Women in the Law courses, and the constitutional part of that Women in the Law course was really being framed by the ACLU's Women's Rights Project. In other words, we were learning about what Ruth Bader Ginsburg was doing to litigate, to break down. People don't recall that in the 70s, the law embodied discrimination against women. There were rules that women could do X or Y. Women couldn't, you know, serve on juries. Women, women couldn't be executors of wills if a man was contesting it. The law embodied discrimination against women in very fundamental and explicit ways, and she was sort of steadfastly knocking them down. And there would be a Women in the Law conference where all of us 20-somethings would go, and she would be the keynote speaker. And I was blown away. She's a very soft-spoken speaker, but the message had a clarity to it which has never dimmed, and a clarity to the relationship between legal discrimination and societal discrimination, a concern about the way women were treated in all aspects of life, sort of breaking down what the stereotypes were, you know, woman as mother, woman as child rearer, and men not so much. And she was radical in that vision. I love to quote something out of her first textbook where she talked about how gender discrimination traps not just women, but men in sex roles, you know, provider on the one hand, child care person on the other. And as the mother of sons, I am thrilled that they can envision being caregivers in ways that my father certainly couldn't envision. So I listened to her, and I wanted to be her. The notion of being able to break down the barriers she was breaking down through the law was just irresistible to me.
Renee, if you had to stand in the classroom today and take what Nancy just said, and bring it home to a student by saying, here's something that's different about how we live in Boston today than how we lived in Boston 50 or 60 years ago. Is there a way you could illustrate that?
Well, I think that Nancy gave some very good examples of that, that the public benefits to which everyone contributes, that, you know, the Social Security system, which, you know, seems like this, you know, sort of very dry aspect of our lives, although incredibly important to people's ability to sustain themselves financially. And she saw in the, you know, sex stereotypes embedded in the Social Security benefits structure for widows and widowers, a persistent stereotyping according to sex roles and the assumptions about what roles people would bring in their play in their families. The other case that's similar to that is the Frontiero against Richardson case, which is the one about military dependents, that male members of the military services, their spouses and families were automatically considered their dependents, but women members of the military had to show that their families actually depended on their income in order to claim them as dependents from the military system. And so these kinds of stereotypes really do affect on a day-to-day basis how people live. And we now take for granted that that sort of thing is not permissible anymore. But I think, it's hard for people to believe that, as Nancy said, it's very recent in our history, you know, within the last 40 years, that these barriers have been changed. The other thing I wanted to say was, harkening back to something that Dean Kass was talking about when he was on a few minutes before we joined you, was her approach to other kinds of cases as well. And one of the things that I find really impressive is that she was always focused on, what was the purpose of a law? Was a Congress or a state legislature really trying to help and protect people, or was the law, trying to convey and enforce one of these stereotypes again? And I think that that her focus on the government's role as being a protector of people, of providing resources for them to live their lives effectively, is a very important ethos that I think is missing in some parts of the political culture these days, where there's an ideology that says that, you know, everybody is on their own and that anything the government might do to help you should be unconstitutional. And so I think that her ethos of the government being a source of sustenance for ordinary people is a really important one.
We are talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her legacy with retired federal judge Nancy Gertner and professor of law Renee Landers from Suffolk University. You can join that conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nancy, we have some tape from 2013 when Justice Ginsburg had the honor at the New York City Bar Association to introduce you. And here is a little bit of what she said that night.
Her approach to opinion writing follows a model I strive to employ as well. As Nancy put it, I always tried to write the first four paragraphs of my opinion in English. I want my position to be as clear and accessible as I can make it.
So then we spoke earlier today with Harvard Law professor Michael Klarman, who clerked for Justice Ginsburg in 83 to 84 when she was a fairly new judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And one of the main things he took away was how to be a better writer.
Clerks would often write the first draft of an opinion, but early in the term, it would come back massacred. But by the end of the year, we aspired to writing draft opinions that she didn't have to massacre, and she would just edit in ways that made them better. So that was something we really appreciated. She's the hardest working person I've ever known in my life.
I just love the poetry of that she's talking about what a great writer that you actually wrote your opinions in English, and she admired that in you, that you wanted to be like her when you were younger. And now we have this clerk who says that it was the ability, her ability to write, that made the greatest impression on him. There is something there about how the legal community affect each other, isn't there?
That's one thing, and also the way that the legal community, that she wanted to speak to the public. You know, that when you, I've read everything that she has written, all the opinions that she's written, rather, since she's been on the Supreme Court. And she was, as someone described, it was the long game. The things she was saying as soon as she got on the Supreme Court mirrored what she had been saying when she was a litigator. She was essentially trying to educate the public, educate her fellow judges about the perniciousness of gender discrimination. The fact that if most women are X, that doesn't mean that the individual woman who can do Y shouldn't be given that opportunity. The fact that, you know, talking about, helping women, protective labor legislation actually, as she described it, seemed to put women on a pedestal, but actually was a cage. The fact that restrictions on roles affected men as well as women. That there are real physical differences between men and women, but that's the beginning of the discussion, not the end. Those physical differences may, in fact, have no role in an employment setting or a limited role. These are themes that she said in the 1970s, and her oral arguments before the Supreme Court when she was a young lawyer were educating the court, and her decisions when she was a judge was involved educating the public over and over again. It was really, it's hard to imagine someone who was able to create a body of law as a litigator and then cite that body of law when she's a justice. I mean, her contributions are just irreplaceable.
Well, I just want to point out that she did spend a great part of her career at the beginning as a teacher, as a law professor. We don't tend not to think about a direct teaching role, but I think that she saw the impact that that role could have on her students. And I think she just sort of translated that to her audiences on the court and to the public. I think that the judge that I clerked for, one of his primary beliefs was that principally judges were teachers of the public about the law. And I think Bader Ginsburg really embodied that sensibility. I also wanted to say that, everybody, not everybody, but people have this notion that people who become successful sometimes, have had sort of been on the glide path, for their entire careers. And I think that her career is evidence that that doesn't have to be true. First of all, there's the gender discrimination, and then all of the sort of personal challenges that she had to overcome in her life, her mother dying shortly before she graduated from high school, her husband, becoming very seriously ill when they were both in law school, and her having to bear the burden of, the responsibility of, child care, and really making sure that they both made it through law school in fine shape is just an impressive feat. And you never had the sense that she felt in any way resentful or put upon that she had to bear these challenges, that these are just things that happen to people in life. And we have to, play the hand that we're dealt and try to do the best we can with it. And I think that that's another important example that she has given us.
Let's go to the phones here. And I do want to acknowledge we're having a little bit of some sound feedback in the background. I'm sorry about that. It is sometimes the challenge of broadcasting virtually. Let's take Kira from Concord. Kira, go ahead.
Hi, Tiziana, and hi, Nancy, and hi to your guests there. I just wanted to say that I thought that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was just an amazing woman, as well as Supreme Court Justice. And she imparted to us grace under pressure, and she also was really just extraordinary.
Thank
in
you,
so
Kira.
Many ways
Thanks
more than I can express at this time, and I'm definitely a little nervous, so my apologies, but it's not you all, it's just that this is such a wonderful woman and person and teacher. And
so I'll take it from you from there, Kira. Thank you. I hear that you are nervous, but you gave us a wonderful word to work with there, which is grace, and it's something that I want to come back to. But I'm briefly going to pick up one more call before we do that. We've got Aaron on the line from Andover.
Hi. I am saddened in so many ways by the passing of Justice Ginsburg, but what my biggest concern right now is how quickly the Republican Party has jockey to put somebody forward to replace her, especially given what happened 4 years ago with Merrick Garland. But there's also a piece of me that wonders, if the roles were reversed and the Democrats were in power and we lost conservative justice, would they be doing it any better? Or would the hypocrisy be there with either party?
That's a great question, Aaron. I'm going to take it back from you. And in our last couple of minutes here, my last question to both Judge Gertner and Professor Landers, I want to put together this political tension that this moment has clearly brought forward, but also Kira's note of grace. And what is your wish for her legacy of building friendships across political divides, of wanting a court that had a vision and led for the country? What's your wish in this moment? I'm going to ask each of you that as my last question. Nancy Gertner, I'll go to you first.
Well, I think that what people don't understand about Justice Ginsburg is that she was really a moderate as a judge in so many ways, reaching across the aisle, but trying. She cared deeply about precedent. She cared deeply about her relationship with her colleagues. She didn't want, acerbic dissents. She wanted to sort of move the court as a consensus, as opposed to divided political division, was something that was anathema to her, and that would be wonderful going forward. What I worry about is that there is a sort of systematic undoing project going on now, just to use that metaphor. That is to say, to take the cases, not just Roe v. Wade, but the cases of the past 30 years, the cases going back to the New Deal, and undo them based on one political philosophy. She was not like that and would never have been that way.
How about you, Renee?
I agree with Nancy that she was a person who strove to build consensus, but she did not shy away from real and honest disagreement when she felt that the law required it, which is different than being disagreeable just for the point of being disagreeable and trying to undo things that people have come to rely on, not just in abortion, but the Affordable Care Act. These are all things that could be at risk if the court moves in a very determined conservative direction. And I will point out that one of the reasons that the law changed is that we tried things the way they used to be, and they weren't working out so well for ordinary people. And so people, I think that the courts and the political actors who are involved in choosing people who sit on the federal courts have to be cognizant that, to borrow Nancy's phrase, that this is a long game. And that these constant shifts back and forth into polar opposite positions are not the way a legal system or a society can function.
That's Renee Landers, professor of law and director of the health law concentration at Suffolk University. Thank you, Renee.
Thank you.
And WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner, a retired federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thanks.
Thanks.
It has been months in the making, but today, students and staff return to the Boston Public Schools. In a video for students and parents, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh had this message as the day kicked off.
We spent the summer making our school building safe for everyone and revamping online learning, and we're ready to have a successful year. It's okay to feel nervous or uncertain. Nothing about 2020 has felt normal.
So how did it feel as the school day comes to an end? How'd it go today? WBUR's Carrie Young has been keeping up with it and joins us now. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Carrie, I'll just ask you, how did it go? What are you hearing?
Yeah, so I've been checking in with several people throughout the day, and from what I've been hearing is so far so good overall. A couple people said that they had a few tech issues, but nothing major. One thing I have been hearing a little bit of is an issue with their system for marking kids present or absent. But other than that, I've seen a couple of reports on Twitter about spilled juice or water on keyboards and a little bit of yawning during class time. So some things would be expected either way, but overall,
I was going to say, juice and yawning sound like things that would happen regardless of where you did your schooling today. So what are you hearing from parents and students? What are the reactions? How are people feeling about it?
Yeah, well, going into this first day here in Boston, I've been talking to a lot of parents, especially before things got going. One way I did that was to drop in on the Countdown to Kindergarten event last week, and really you could feel this sense of mostly excitement and a little bit of anxiety. One mom, Jasmine Velasquez, her son was going into kindergarten, and she said he was very excited to start big boy school this week. But for her, she was, you know, a little bit concerned about him because he's a very visual learner, and, you know, she's really not sure how he's going to do with the Zoom classroom.
Interacting with other kids and professors, his teachers and everything. So it does make me a little bit nervous that he's going to be seeing them through a computer screen.
What about teachers, Carrie? Especially this has been contentious coming into the beginning of this school year. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of negotiations that have been going on, in the last couple weeks, even probably the last several days. And union leaders for right now, from what I'm hearing, is that, you know, overall, teachers are glad that the district is starting the year remotely rather than just jumping right into in-person instruction and that hybrid model. I'm also hearing that there has been a lot of progress made in that quality of remote teaching. Last year, it was sort of this crisis schooling, sort of everyone just tried their best and, there wasn't as much training around it. This year, it's definitely different, more professional development. There's less of a learning curve and anxiety around that. But there is some anxiety building from some teachers that I've heard of, around how hybrid learning is going to work, because that's something that they haven't done before, balancing both kids at home and some in their classroom. So I talked to East Boston kindergarten teacher Alana Ainsworth about this. And she said it's all of the unanswered questions that are making her nervous.
I understand. Yeah, we're going to have these cameras that follow teachers around. But, like, what if I'm supposed to be teaching a kid one-on-one? Like, it's just a lot of those little details. And, like, I'm in kindergarten, so we have to take the kids to the bathroom and toileting and accidents happen. And where's the PPE for that? Because I still haven't seen it in the office.
Yeah, so I mean, as you can hear, there are definitely a lot of questions for a lot of different scenarios that are just going to have to be like worked through. We did hear from Boston Superintendent Brenda Caselius about this. She addressed that very concern on WBUR's Morning Edition today, and here's how she responded.
That is a very valid concern. However, I do think as they get into the classroom and as they do that work with one another and they learn from one another, that it'll become less burdensome and less bumpy for them.
So let's compare and contrast, Carrie, because Boston had a delayed start compared to some other districts. Are things different in Boston than elsewhere in this first day or so?
I mean, for the most part, no, from what I can tell. There are quite a few districts that did try that hybrid learning approach right off the bat. I know that that was the case in Lexington. That's where I was last week. And there are a lot of other districts like that, whereas Boston, however, is phasing in. You know, they're not having students come into the building until next month. So that's some of the differences that I'm seeing. But again, they are not alone in this. Boston was a little bit later than most districts in starting. And that was something that came up in negotiations with their teachers, and that they really used that time for professional development for things like improving their remote teaching that we talked about earlier, and then also just, you know, working on ways for teachers to they're expecting more trauma for kids to come in having experienced trauma from this time away from the classroom. So they really took the time to get teachers and school support staff trained up on how to effectively deal with that coming in this this fall.
So, Carrie, you've had this really unique catbird seat these last couple of weeks as schools have begun to come back in all of these different modes. Is there anything that has particularly surprised you or stood out to you or that is of particular note that you weren't expecting as you've watched this unfold and talked to all these communities?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just keep going back to one of the very first days of when the school building shut down and just being in that Boston administration building. And the lights were off and it was dark and it's this like usually bustling building, you know, going from that point, at that point, it seemed like, oh, how are we going to get to this first day of school? It was such a monumental task. And yet here we are. There was so much work that was done, you know, whether it was in Boston or in other districts to try to like logistically plan out how all of this is going to work. And so, you know, there are some points of tension still. There's negotiations that are still ongoing. But for the most part, I mean, I've heard from most people, I've heard excitement about today and these last couple weeks, depending on where you started. So I think I don't want to say that's surprising. Maybe that was pleasantly surprising that there wasn't as much animosity going into this. It's more excitement because people just want to get started, get back to that routine, and, you know, try to get back to some sort of normalcy there.
That's WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, we're going to continue to watch this unfold. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
The Great Scott in Alston appears one step closer to resurrection. The beloved local rock club announced in May that it would be closing permanently because of the pandemic. But longtime concert booker Carl Lavin started a crowdfunding campaign to save it in a new space. And so now it looks like Lavin's on the edge of a deal to move the venue to the site of Regina Pizzeria in Alston, which also closed because of the coronavirus. And Carl Lavin joins us now. Carl, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me back. I continue to be excited every time it happens.
Well, it's fun to have you, especially under the circumstances, Carl. We did this segment a couple of weeks ago. You were one of the people that we spoke with about the impact of the pandemic on the music scene in Boston. You were hopeful then about this possibility of moving Great Scott to the Alston Depot where Regina's used to be. But I hear you have now signed a letter of intent with the landlord. Is that right?
That is a fact, and yeah, it's such an encouraging step. You know, it reinforces some of the things that we talked about just what it can be like when you know, an initiative like this meets up with you know, a landlord and ownership group that you know, shares. The same, you know, shares and recognizes the importance of live music in Boston and things along those lines. So the fact that we're even at this step is just it's in some ways mind-boggling, but in most ways just super encouraging and reassuring. And I'm very excited about where we're going.
I hear your excitement, and I know this is a step forward. It is a step, right? A letter of intent isn't a lease yet, and I think you've got to raise some more money to get to that point where you can sign the lease. How much more do you need to raise?
Well, so we definitely need to raise more money, more, you know, through the investment campaign, through the amazing people at MainVest. And so it's not so much that we need, you know, X amount more dollars. It's just what I'm hoping to, attract through, additional investment is now that we've crossed the threshold of the acquisition, cost now, it's great, you know, Regina, as great as it was, wasn't exactly laid out like a perfect rock and roll club. So there's going to be a lot of renovations and build outs,
yeah,
and things along those lines. So what we're trying to do,
Carl, tell us specifically about that. Yeah, tell us specifically about those. What does it take to turn a pizza restaurant into the concert venue you envision for Great Scott?
Well, so So Regina had an amazing bar. It was really big. And it's wrapped around, and I'm sure hundreds, if not thousands, if mm-hmm. not tens of thousands of people have enjoyed slices of pizza and things at it. But no matter where we want to put the stage in the space, that bar is right in the way. Like, there's just no way around it. So we're going to have to move some things around as far as that goes, relocate the bar, adjust the direction of the tap lines, adjust some things to make sure that, the space, which is amazing, of course, but, you know, there are some acoustic challenges that are going to need to be addressed in order to make sure that, you know, that we're giving, given the fans and the bands that play there the same level of, you know, otherworldly expertise and perfection that Great Scott has always provided as far as the sound for both the fans and the artists that perform.
So for the fans and the bands, as you just said, who are listening and interested, what is your timeline for reopening? When might, I mean, obviously we have to keep in mind the phases of the pandemic as well in phase four for bars, but you will be serving pizza there. So what's the timeline?
Right. Yeah. So our great, and I'm really excited to be partnering up and teaming up with Rock City Pizza out of Alston. Shout out to Rock City. They're open right now if you want to go get some slices or some pizzas and some subs. That part of it, it's a little bit more turnkey because the kitchen is in place. It's all got the same, you know, hookups for pizza and everything like that. So their end of things will be able to open before what we need to do, regardless of which phase we're in or not. I know that it's going to take a while to do a lot of the, the construction and the reconfiguration on our end of things. But, it's our hope that, that the pizza side of things will be able to just be up and running as soon as we can hook some ovens up and get it going. So like once the lease is signed, it'll be a lot easier to do the pizza side of things before we can actually get started.
So Carl,
on the rock show stuff.
With that in mind, with the rock show stuff in mind, just the poster headline of the first dream show you have in mind when there's music at Great Scott. What's that headline?
Well, Speedy Ortiz has been so important, not only as a band, but collectively as a band throughout their ascent, but also as patrons and also as supporters of the music scene. It's hard to pick a different band to try and have play on the first one. So if that could be how it goes, it would be as awesome as it can get.
Excellent. That's Carl Lavin, longtime booker and possible future owner of Great Scott. Carl, thanks.
Thank you.
And we are going out today with the Speedy Ortiz song, It's No Below, performed live at Great Scott in 2013. That's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.